Welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. What did George Washington do that you might not know about? What did Abe Lincoln know that could change the way you think about the Civil War? You'll learn about all that and more on this special show designed to restore excitement in American history. Let's get started.
You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. Today, we're going to take a bit of a departure from our usual patient safety topics to visit with a guest whose goal is to educate children and adults about history. Now, because our history, our past, makes us and our country who and what we are right now, it behooves us to understand and appreciate what took place as a way to recognize some of our positions today. It's like genealogy in that it gives us an understanding of who we are. So with that, let me introduce David Bruce Smith, founder of the Grateful American Foundation. David has a bachelor's degree in American literature from George Washington University and a master's in journalism from New York University. During the past 20 years, he has been a real estate executive and the editor-in-chief and publisher of Crystal City Magazine. He is the author of 11 books, and his company, David Bruce Smith Publications, specializes in creating, designing, and composing limited edition books on a variety of subjects, authors, historic figures, artists, and leaders. David Bruce Smith Publications is committed to educating young children through books, literature, and historic sites. And on President's Day in 2014, he founded the Grateful American Foundation, an organization dedicated to restoring enthusiasm in American history for kids and adults. And you can learn more at gratefulamericanfoundation.com. So it's with great pleasure to welcome you to the show, David.
Thank you very much.
Well, as I mentioned to you briefly before our phone call here today, history was not one of my favorite topics in school, but yet now I find that in order to understand today's political climate, I need to look back and understand how we got where we are today. So what inspired you to launch the Grateful American Foundation?
Well, a couple of things. I think it started with my father, who always referred to himself as a Grateful American, and he felt fortunate for all the opportunities he had. And I guess you could say that those feelings rubbed off. So I took his sentiment and turned it into a noun.
You know, a lot of our older generation really do and did feel fortunate to be here. And I think a lot of times the younger groups, even me growing up, I guess we didn't feel that fortunate. We didn't think about it. It was like, all right, well, this is just the way it is. And so why pay attention? So it's kind of interesting that you took that ball and ran with it. So what are your goals for the project?
Well, one of them is to restore enthusiasm about American history for kids and adults, because it's really important, I think, for people to have some context. Otherwise, they can't manage their civic responsibilities intelligently. And by that, I mean voting or understanding a document. Or I think, you know, it's cliche, but in order to understand who you are, you need to know where you came from.
Right. And that's why I mentioned genealogy. It's kind of like that, to look back to say, who were your ancestors? And that's what our history is. It's basically our ancestry.
You know, I had a 12th grade history teacher who once said that history is like a one big gossip session. She said, think of it as his story. So a lot of times what happens in schools, kids are expected to, you know, take on, you know, 200 years of events, and it's too daunting. So you made a reference to Ancestry.com. It would be better for kids to be able to pick a period that they like. This would be as an introduction, mm-hmm. and then treat it as an Ancestry.com, because it would be a starting point.
Right.
And then from there, you know, one thing can lead to another. You're not always going to get a grab, but you might increase your chances.
Well, exactly, because I remember growing up, we would have to memorize timelines and dates and years and then just spew that right back out. Without a context to it, you really didn't even know what or why you were doing that. So what do you think? Is it the textbooks that are not interesting? Or what do you think is the problem for getting children and young people enthused about learning history?
Well, very often, I think there are a few things. Very often, you either don't have a teacher who is interested. And, you know, the school system says, okay, gym teacher, you're going to teach history. Mm-hmm. But that person is not credentialed, not interested, and that's passed on to the students. The other thing is, I can tell you for a fact, when my daughter was in 11th grade and I would see the history books that she would bring home, I couldn't believe it. They were so boring and so dense and so dry. No wonder she still hates history. Mm-hmm. She's grown up now. And the other thing is, textbooks are not universal in how they treat events. For example, Abraham Lincoln wouldn't be taught the same way in the North as he is in the South. I was at a memorial service for the gentleman who used to run Mount Vernon. His name was Jim Reese. This was last year. And one of the speakers at the funeral said, you know, Jim was a lover of history, but the focus has changed. 30 years ago, George Washington would have gotten 3 pages, and now George Washington gets a paragraph, and Marilyn Monroe gets 3 pages. Mm. Now, there's nothing wrong with Marilyn Monroe, but that's not the right context for her.
That's interesting. I never thought about how demographics might play into what students are learning about history.
Right. So it's not uniform. It's often by committee. It's often political. Now, my other child, my son, he hated history. And then in 8th grade, he was rescued by a great, really great history teacher. And he continued to have luck. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, he was always a patriotic kid. He's at the Naval Academy now.
Oh.
And part of that, I believe, is because of the background that he got in history.
Would you say the home environment has something to do with it as well?
Yes, it did have something to do with it because I was a big reader of biographies. And, you know, we were taught that it was important to give back to society. My father was in the reserves. His other grandfather enlisted. Now, when I asked my son, how is it that he ended up, why is it that he wanted to go to the Naval Academy when he was 9 years old, that might have influenced him, all those things. Mm-hmm. But the reason he gives is that it was just in his DNA. And he wants to defend the country in a very active way. That means being a SEAL.
Mm, wow.
So, I mean, so he, all of us have been around, I don't know, my father always said we were the luckiest country, people in the U.S. are the luckiest people in the world because of democracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many opportunities for us that nobody has. And my mother and father were very active in Monticello and Mount Vernon and President Lincoln's cottage and Benjamin Franklin's home in London and others. And there's nothing that gave them more pleasure than to see kids getting educated about the country and enjoying it.
Right. Now, it also seems that adults don't really know much more than children do. Through conversations with people, sometimes you get that feeling that they don't have a background in history. What do you think of that? Is that a problem as well?
I think it's a big problem. Mm-hmm. There is the American Revolution Center, which is building a museum in Philadelphia. It's dedicated solely to the revolution. Now, I didn't know there wasn't something dedicated solely to the revolution already until I learned about this organization. Anyway, they did a survey in 2011, and the results of the survey were that 89% of the respondents believed that the Revolutionary War took place after the Civil War. Now, it was that statistic that really propelled me to create the Grateful American Foundation, because that convinced me that things were really bad. Mm-hmm. And it also convinced me that this is a multi-generational problem that's going to take a while, maybe 25 years, to fix. But I do think, you know, there are a lot of people around who are trying to remedy it. One of the things that could be done that I'm not aware that it's happening yet is, you know, most school districts, it doesn't matter where you are strapped for cash. It would be really nice if businesses would put money into these curriculum, either by funding textbooks, field trips, seminars, because the kids who are being taught now are going to be their future employees. And I would think they'd rather have a historically literate group of people rather than not. The other thing, getting back to your earlier question, what else can be done to make history interesting, mm-hmm. is, since the textbooks tend to be boring, not all, but many, primary and secondary sources are interesting for kids to read. I mean, if you don't want to read something boring about the Civil War, you could read a Civil War diary or something like that.
Right, right.
That would be a primary source. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an idea that I have. I don't know that anybody's doing it. It would certainly be an improvement over what we've got.
As you're speaking, I was thinking about older generations, maybe because there wasn't the access that we have now. So as history was actually being made, we didn't have all the technology, you know, even before TVs, people couldn't really watch it on TV or maybe could just hear it on the radio. But now with all of these media outlets and opportunities that we have to see what's really going on in real time, maybe just through that, the future generations may become a little more historically literate just because they've had more opportunity to be a part of it.
That's probably true, as long as what we're seeing is not just a soundbite, because then it's distorted.
That's true, too.
But the other thing is, our parents were part of the close to the World War II generation, and that was a very patriotic generation. So people, I think, were more up because, I mean, horrible things were going on, Pearl Harbor, and now the country is not, well, probably the closest that the country got to being mobilized psychologically was 9/11.
Yes.
And there was a lot of patriotism for, a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could feel it. But, you know, as time passes, you know, my kids were little. Now they're big. They remember it. But kids being born now, I mean, by the time they're, you know, 10, it will be so remote. It won't have the same effect unless, you know, they're continuously reminded.
Mm-hmm. So then how do you make it come alive? I mean, how do you keep that excitement growing and out there for people to learn more about American history and reigniting their passion for the folks that founded our country?
Well, I think the most important thing, as I said before, is the teacher. You said earlier that your experience in high school or in school wasn't great with teachers. And, I mean, I really think that a teacher can make or break somebody's interest, and it doesn't have to be history. It can be anything. The other thing is, kids can't go to, say, a presidential home and just read a bunch of cards. They have to do what Mount Vernon and Monticello and Lincoln's Cottage have done, which is to make it interactive. At Mount Vernon, as a matter of fact, they have a whole forensic thing, a whole forensic display, because nobody really knows what George Washington looked like. So there's a whole thing that kids can do to try to figure out what he really looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is, off to the side, for little kids, there's play, games and things like that to engage them. That didn't exist 15 years ago.
Right.
So I think all these places are trying to capture bigger audiences. There's a theater at Mount Vernon. I think the movie is about Valley Forge and its winters, and during the times where they're projecting the winters, it starts to snow in the theater.
Oh.
So it's very clever what a lot of these places are now doing. Mm-hmm. And I once asked the director of President Lincoln's Cottage, what happens if you have a visitor, a kid especially, who is bored? I really liked her answer. She said, you know what? If a kid is bored here, then it's our fault.
Oh.
So I thought that was a very interesting way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, Lincoln is such a... I did a book on Lincoln once, and one of the things I learned was, other than Christ, he's the most written about person in the history of the world.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's definitely beloved. He's the perfect example to engage with.
Well, now, you also then offer interactive kind of experiences through your Grateful American TV show and through your radio show, so it's beyond folks just reading about it. You've also embraced other ways to educate and to inform. And you've also interviewed dozens of the leaders of the nation's biggest presidential homes, including Mount Vernon, as you said, Monticello, Montpelier, Lincoln's Cottage, and Benjamin Franklin's house in London. Is there anything that sticks out of any of those that you would like to share with us?
One of the things that amazes me is, you go to these homes, and it's really exciting to know that you're walking in the space that one of these people lived in. But the amazing thing is, if you think of James and Dolly Madison, Abigail and John Adams, George Washington, Martha, Paul Revere, that whole group, it's amazing that they all lived at the same time the country was created, and probably, this is a matter of opinion, but probably there's never been a better group alive all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you mentioned Lincoln earlier. Is Lincoln your favorite president, or do you have another?
Lincoln is my favorite president.
I figured.
Now, he's not a founding father.
No.
But he is probably one of the best receptacles of their ideas.
Right.
But the reason why he's my favorite president, he freed the slaves, and so with the Emancipation Proclamation, there was now something that both sides could fight against that was concrete. And it was the beginning. He propelled, probably unbeknownst to him, he propelled civil rights. So if that hadn't, so would we have had an Obama now? I don't know, but let's just say Lincoln had not written the Emancipation Proclamation. Who would have freed the slaves? It wouldn't have been Andrew Johnson or Grant or Hayes or Garfield. So who knows? When would it have happened? Civil rights still isn't resolved, but we're a lot better than we were, say, 50 years ago.
I'm also, as you're speaking, I was thinking, I'm asking you about the president, but your favorite president, but what about the women? The first ladies have always played a fairly important role as well. Do you have some of your...
Oh, I have great ideas. I have definite ideas about the ladies. See, one of the things I've said to Mount Vernon and Montpelier and Lincoln Cottage, if you have a couple that's really dynamic, then... It should be, Mount Vernon should be, I think, promoted as George and Martha. Quincy, which is where the Adamses live, should be Abigail and John Adams, and then Mary Todd Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln. Because Adams and Madison, in my opinion, would not have made it to the White House without their wives. John Adams was not the most pleasant guy, but she evened him out, and James Madison was kind of not much personality, but she was very savvy and very personable and kind of like a Pearl Mesta. And there's this story about when he was running, when Madison was running for his second term in 1808, the guy's name is Pinckney. He was the opponent. And when he lost, he said, well, had I been running against just Mr. Madison, I would have won. But I was running against Mr. and Mrs. Madison.
Ooh.
And she was the real powerhouse, mm-hmm. politically speaking. I mean, he was bright and all that, but she was a real, I think Dolly is quite something. Now, if you want to propel that into the modern times, I would say that Ronald Reagan would never have made it mm-hmm. to the White House without Nancy Reagan. She's the same version of Mary Todd Lincoln.
Interesting. Wow.
Or if you want to think of it the other way around, Mary Todd Lincoln is the pathological version of Nancy Reagan.
Mm-hmm. And it seems in recent times it was Jackie that kind of brought first ladies to the forefront. At least that appears that way to me.
Yeah, I mean, I she's just so classy,
elegant,
and educated, and quiet in her influence. I think people will always appreciate her. I hope more comes out about her, the substantial part of her influence, rather than, you know, just the fashion and all
right.
that. You know, it's coming out now. I read something yesterday that I knew she spoke French and Spanish. I didn't know she spoke Italian. But, you know, there's more and more, I think, will come out about how really smart. And she was a advisor to him, mm-hmm. to JFK.
Well, as they say, behind every man is a strong woman, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even, you know, Bess Truman, who you never hear anything about,
mm-hmm.
she's not my favorite. I love Truman, but he used to say, or at least that's what I read, that he could not have, you know, made the worst decision of his life, which was to drop the bomb mm-hmm. without her.
I think, was it PBS that recently, recently re-aired the First Ladies?
Right.
Yeah, that was so interesting. I really enjoyed that.
I mean, there have been some great First Ladies. I mean, some of them I don't know much about. I don't know anything really about Grace Coolidge or some of the earlier ones, but, I mean, definitely... I mean, the ones we've talked about are, Lady Bird Johnson.
Right.
Really among the best. But I think I went off track a little. I think that if some of these homes would promote the homes as a they rather than a him.
Yes.
It would, you know, that would interest little girls, would say, oh, you know. I mean, it's important, especially for a girl, to know that these women grew up and became whatever.
Yeah, I think if they're giving out assignments in school, I think for young girls to have to spend some time studying about a specific first lady, I think that would be a lot more attractive to them rather than memorizing the timeline or even studying about the president. It's just a little bit of something that they can relate to.
Right. And you know, when I was at Montpelier last year, I asked the director there, I said, you know, my feeling is that many more people know about Dolly Madison versus James Madison. I said, is that true or is that just a misperception? And she said, no, I mean, more people know about her than him. And so, you know, my question would be, well, then why isn't she emphasized?
Mm-hmm.
Because she's more interesting. I mean, that's a way to, I mean, if you want to grab a kid, you've got to, you know, go and via the way that's interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So for the Madisons, it would be definitely Dolly. For Adams, if it weren't for David McCullough writing John Adams, well, he would be something obscure. But Abigail is much more interesting, I think, than he was.
Well, this is a good conversation because I think it can give our listeners a starting point to say, hey, well, let me look into some of these. Because I agree, when I watched that series on TV, I just found that fascinating. It was information I never heard of before. Yep, and why?
This is the inaugural year of the Grateful American Book Prize. So, and this is, this prize is for 7th to 9th graders, and the submissions are from any historical period, but it has to be historical fiction or nonfiction. It's the only prize, ironically, in existence in that genre.
Right, we just need to find those little nuggets and make it relevant for the classroom.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, for a teacher who's really crackerjack, it's easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's as the director of the Lincoln Cottage said, if you're, you know, if a kid is bored, then it's the fault of the person passing on the information.
Right, right. Well, now, if you could accomplish one thing with the Grateful American Foundation, what would that be?
To make history fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're doing that with your videos and your radio shows. So with that, where can listeners find out more about you and what you do? Where can they find your videos, your radio shows? Give us all of that information as we wrap up.
They can go to davidbrucesmith.com or they can go to gratefulamericanfoundation.com. Or another avenue for the videos is YouTube and then key in Grateful American Series.
All righty. So we have davidbrucesmith.com or gratefulamericanfoundation.com.
If they just want to go right to the video,
yep.
Grateful American Series.
Grateful American Series. Okay. Excellent. Well, I know there's so much more, obviously, that we could cover today, but any last-minute thoughts that you would like to share, anything in particular?
The last question you asked me was, you know, what did I want to accomplish? You know, just for people to make this learning of history simple and unencumbered and fun. And if you can do that, the rest usually follows. If you do what they did to you and me and, you know, you have to... You learn 100 dates, nobody, almost nobody, wants to do it. It's a drag.
Yeah, it is. It is. But you're spicing things up. So I encourage everyone to visit your websites that we talked about, view and listen to your videos and your radio programs, because they do provide an easy-to-digest educational way for children, parents, grandparents, or anyone with an interest in history to find out and learn more. And I'm grateful to have met you and to share you with our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in history for kids and adults, too.